All right, time for Truth About Markets New Zealand with Max and Stacy.
Hi, New Zealand. Hi, Christchurch.
So, Stacy, we're talking about silver, and we're talking about silver manipulation. We're talking about the CFTC is accepting testimony this past week from Bill Murphy over there at the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, because people have been saying for years that the price of silver and the price of gold are manipulated. And now they've got a hearing and they've been talking to the CFTC. So what's been going on? Have you been following this at all?
I haven't had a chance to actually watch the video of his testimony. But they laid out, Bill Murphy brought in a guy who was formerly, I guess, with J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
And he explained how they manipulated the price of silver.
Yeah.
Again, you know, this didn't get much mainstream media attention, if any at all.
Right.
It was streamed live on television, online, and GATA.org has covered it, but nobody else in the mainstream. So, you know, corruption goes unnoticed in the mainstream. The entire rigging of what used to be called financial markets has gone unnoticed. People still view our markets as markets,
mm-hmm.
as price discovery mechanisms and allocation of capital mechanisms and, free markets. Mm. But as you see, the rigged market capitalism, nobody reports on the rigging part of it or how that's done.
No, it's like that old Woody Allen joke. The man goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, my brother thinks he's a chicken." The doctor says, "No problem. Have your brother take these pills." And the guy says, "No, no, you don't understand. We need the eggs."
Yeah.
So these markets are phantasmagorical representations of nonsensical insider trading schemes perpetrated by market manipulators and arbitrageurs on Wall Street in the City of London, and nobody cares as long as they can get a commission.
Well, but the population, most people are conservative. They don't, and in terms of they're afraid of change, most people don't want change because change could be presented to them in many ways. And they, for example, if you hear, you know, you go to comment sections on, say, articles about ending the Fed, and you see lots and lots of people are actually afraid of ending the Fed because they think it will cause deflation. They think it will be hardship. They think they'll have no access to credit.
Right.
Nobody mentions inflation or the inflation tax and the secrecy and the cartels of bankers behind it. That is something they don't want to know how the magic happens. Like you've talked about as a magician yourself, that people get angry to know the magic tricks.
That's right. They don't really want to know, even though they beg you, tell me how it's done. They don't want you to tell it how it's done. And if you do tell them how it's done, they hate you for it. But no matter how many articles, no matter how many testimonials, no matter how much rock solid evidence there is proving that the COMEX and the NYMEX are being manipulated, people refuse to accept it. And it's similar to the Catholic Church scandal. No matter how many of these pedophiles situations emerge, people are still just looking the other way because they're afraid, like, well, what happens if we got rid of the Catholic Church? I mean, what would happen? They're afraid that to take action. Similar to the way that gold and silver and the price of money itself through the Church of Central Banking keeps manipulating rates and the price of cash around the world as part of this entrenched oligopoly, and people are afraid to consider what would be the situation if we simply got away with all these monopolists and oligopolists, even though obviously the upside would be tremendous for anyone who's not a skeeving, cream-skimming, Goldman Sachs-type banker.
Yeah, so the manipulation of gold and silver, one of the explanations for it is, of course, to support the dollar, to make the dollar look stronger. But more importantly, in this debt-based economies we have, is by keeping the price of gold lower than where it should be, it allows the central banks to keep interest rates lower than they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And it also keeps to create the volatility. They don't even they just need downside volatility as well. So to make people afraid to put their money into gold, which for some reason is always perceived, is always called a risky investment, even though it's been around for over 5,000 years as a currency.
Yeah, you can't control interest rates without also controlling gold.
Yes.
Because otherwise, you know, the you need to control both sides. Now, in terms of volatility, you got to think of it this way. You know, like as a diving board, I don't know if you've ever dove off a diving board.
Of course I have, yeah.
Okay, you know that you go to the end of the diving board and you bounce on the diving board, you jump up and down, and the length of the diving board and the flexibility of the diving board, you know, adds to the propulsion of the weight at the tip of the diving board, and it works to increase the amplitude of the trip from height to bottom of the trip one makes bouncing on the tip of a diving board, as opposed to if you tried the same thing halfway down the diving board. If you're jumping up and down halfway down the diving board, you're only going to be moving maybe half an inch.
Yeah.
At the end of the diving board, it's a foot. Now, the same thing with interest rates. If interest rates are low, then the volatility at the end is high. If interest rates are high, then the volatility would be low. And since bankers make tons of money on volatility, they like to keep it low. That's why rates are low, because it favors the borrowers and the speculators, and it hurts the workers and the savers. And this is the true war around the world. And we're seeing pushback around the world. We're seeing unions in the UK now, the BA is on strike. You've got in America, you've got a union in Mojave Desert in California pushing back against Rio Tinto, an Australian-based mining company, huge conglomerate. You're seeing people, popular uprisings in Iceland, Ireland, and Greece. This is all what's happening, the global insurrection against corporate and banking occupation. These are workers and savers who are fighting against borrowers and speculators.
Well, it's also the end game, really. It's, you know, we had a chart up on our site about debt saturation. And it's at the point where, you know, the central banks are trying everything they could possibly do to maintain the housing bubbles, because this is the one thing that has kept the middle class complicit and quiet about the erosion of their wealth, as Société Générale pointed out in a recent report. Albert Edwards was the author of the report, that it was the central banks helped foster the housing bubbles in order to keep the middle class quiet about the loss of their jobs. But as we see in the UK, for example, we reported on a recent Kaiser report that the number of people in extreme debt has now doubled in the past year to 8,000 people. But the extreme debt is pretty extreme. It's 66 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
And the other article that we've recently highlighted on our site is that the number of people defaulting on rent, not on mortgages, but on rent,
yeah,
and these buy-to-let properties, that this is the basically, you know, as we were saying, this is the cheap rates, as you know, much of the middle class, especially the middle-aged middle class in Britain, all have multiple properties. I have several friends who have multiple properties, property portfolios of letting out to people. But the prices were continuing to rise and rise and rise, where no wages weren't going anywhere. But they're at a debt saturation point now. So nobody can afford to live in those places anymore. The holders of the buy-to-let properties can't afford to lower the sell for cheaper or rent for cheaper. So it's in this collapse stage now.
Right. The house prices were always the way to placate the middle classes. As long as they thought the value of their house was continuing to go up, they would look the other way while some of the rigged market banksters were ripping them off in other ways. But now that the housing market crashed, and now it's getting ready to do something again, and we're going to talk about it when we come right back.
Yeah, so we were talking about this end game of the property market, and as we were saying, you know, Albert Edwards of Soc Gen pointed out the evidence that central banks have been using interest rate policy in order to foster the housing bubble in order to keep the middle class quiet about the erosion of their incomes. But now we're kind of reaching that end game because of debt saturation. So if there's nobody that can afford to rent their properties that the middle class are using as their income,
yeah,
what happens if, you know, nothing, the central banks no longer have any tools?
That's right. You can't push on a string.
And they're trying to push on a string, but
you
there's...
You can't go any lower than zero.
We're at a...
Although quantitative easing is actually lower than zero.
Exactly, but that hasn't... That's only... All the quantitative easing, they're going to have to start doing it to individuals because they're only doing it to the bankers, and bankers aren't extending that quantitative easing money out to the rest of the population.
Well, remember Bush sent everybody a check?
Well, yeah, but...
That's quantitative
easing.
So is
that going to be the next step in order to keep the population quiet?
I believe so.
Because otherwise you're just going to have riots and chaos.
Yes, that's right. Now, the question is, will this result in price inflation? And, yeah, it will at some point. But you still have to get through this overhang of debt. And since nobody is able to give a clear indication of what is yet to be worked through in terms of debt, it's hard to predict when deflation is going to turn to inflation, because every month they inject billions more in various programs, but every month the banks say we've got then again more billions in debt that we just discovered. So when is deflation going to turn to inflation? It's hard to say. Now, in the UK and the US, obviously, or maybe not so obviously, but the housing market in the US is rolling over, and it's going to take another massive haircut. I think people are understanding of this. In the UK, prices are, also not, I don't think, going to do well either. But in places like Canada, where you've got strength in Vancouver and these markets, you've got real estate in Australia and New Zealand is up. So, you know, this is showing that this is opening up the global nature of this inflation and deflation debate. It opens up the global currency flow analysis. It opens up the main question, which is the rally in the resource-rich countries like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, is it sustainable, or has it inherited a lot of the hot money that left these other dying countries' economies, and it's enjoying a spurt as a result? If in fact it's a hot money situation, then we're going to see a rollover, and guys like Steve Keen in Australia are predicting this. Or if it's not, it's a case of decoupling, as iterated by Peter Schiff, where these economies, bolstered by the exports and imports of China and India, are ready to lead the global economy into a new sphere of influence, being in Asia.
Yeah, but on our last Truth About Market show on Resonance in London, you mentioned that we're evolving into a new economics, because with the neoclassical, with the classical economics that we all know, the Australian housing market, as described by Steve Keen, will crash because the debt to GDP, the amount of the average income it takes, the multiple of income that it takes to buy a house, it always has to crash. It has to crash.
Well, on that front, there was a story last week in New Zealand. They just reported some debt numbers, and the New Zealand Kiwi got crushed.
Exactly. So on the economics that we've operated under for the last several hundred years, it will crash. However, if we're able to adopt a Facebook or Google sort of model where it's all fictional, and we can create whatever if we just rewrite the story every month or every year about what the value is of that fictional currency.
Fictional reserve banking.
Exactly, because there's no other way, because with the old economics we had, and the old laws of economics anyway, you can't have house prices be 10 times national average income, because it can't work. You can't sustain that debt.
Right.
Especially now that interest rates are already as low as they possibly can go.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you go? except for to create new laws.
Right. The only way, the only exit is to go to virtual currencies away from fiat currencies. And we talked about this on our previous show. So in other words, people will abandon their fiat currencies, their Canadian dollars, Australian dollars, Kiwi dollars, US dollars, UK pounds, and they will embrace, let's say, Facebook credits, which reward them for spending time online and spending time on Facebook. So in this way, people could aggregate hundreds of billions of credits in their online accounts and pay 0.00000001 in interest on that money. So they could take interest rates down to billionths, hundreds of billionths of a percentage. And people would constantly be trading on Facebook to pay off their interest expense on a monthly basis, which might be $50 a month on a $12 trillion Facebook credit balance. And as this works its way into the system, then and these other currencies are converted into virtual currencies, then at that moment, all of the bad debts and the underwater debts are written off. And we see this in the States already, because Obama's new program in the States is to reduce the principal amount of all the bad loans. So instead of being underwater on your mortgage, you could be write off the portion that is underwater. So your mortgage is, instead of being a $500,000 mortgage, it's now a $200,000 mortgage. So they're already in the process of wiping the equity out of the equation and leaving nothing but debt.
They've also introduced in a few states this new program of mortgage casino, basically. So a mortgage lottery. So they're now randomly paying off people's mortgages.
Right.
And now I wonder if that's some sort of like secret plan to get rid of the debt without creating inflation and fear in foreign investors and U.S. Treasury bonds.
Well, it keeps people from strategically defaulting on their mortgages, because they feel like, well, maybe I'll get lucky and I'll be one of the lucky winners that have their mortgages erased by the state. So I'm not going to walk away from my mortgage, which makes it impossible then for the bank to recoup, you know, anything in a timely basis. So again, they're using casino techniques and behavioral economics to change.
To stay in the game.
Yeah, to change people's mentality, to get them to stay in the game.
That's how they keep you in a casino.
Yeah.
They all those bells and whistles and like loud like sirens that go off when somebody wins, even if it's only $5 at a jackpot, it makes you think like, oh, if I leave now, I'm going to lose. You know, I could have won that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw something on the news last week that I've talked about before, and I hadn't really seen talked about much in the major news outlets, is the student debts. It's kind of somewhat of a switch of a topic here, but these student debts, these students that graduate with $40,000 or $50,000 in debt, they typically are going to migrate toward jobs that pay wages that'll help them pay down that debt as quickly as possible. Oh, and what are those jobs? Oh, they happen to be in the defense business, the military, the espionage business, the surveillance business, the gulag casino business. So this way they can migrate these people from colleges to go directly to support the casino gulag state because they're graduate with such high levels of debt. Had they graduated with no debt, somebody might say, you know what? I think I'll spend 2 years at the Peace Corps. I don't have any debt. I don't have a family. You know, I'll spend 2 years at the Peace Corps. I'll see the world. And maybe that person will end up changing their point of view. Maybe if they end up in a part of the world that they...
Yeah, but the Peace Corps is kind of like an imperial sort of thing as well. It's like those, you know... force neoliberalism on poor people. And
what you don't want are these graduates to go elsewhere in the world and get a different point of view. Because maybe they won't support... wars against these people, you say?
Yeah, but that the U.S. student loan program, you see that passed this past week.
Yeah.
So it's no longer the government. The U.S. government has been giving tens of billions of dollars in federal subsidies to banks to issue loans to students, and trapping these students in debts that are you can't go bankrupt and avoid these mm-hmm. debts. So now the federal government has now removed all those subsidies, and they're now running the program themselves, saving themselves annually billions and billions of dollars that they're now going to put back into Pell Grants.
Yeah. Well, that was a good move. Okay. Now we're back in a second.
Okay, we're back.
Yes, we're back. So, what was I just thinking? The students and their loans, and they have these big loans. Gosh darn it, I had a thought and I forgot it.
So instead of working, so say they want to, do something that's more working with poor people, helping poor people, or helping diseased people, or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, or lesser paid income, lesser paid job. They're going to have to go work for a corporation instead to pay off their debts, or for the CIA or something like that.
Yeah, what I was thinking of is that as part of this healthcare package reform, a lot of companies are coming out and they're pre-announcing losses that they're going to have to take to pay for the new healthcare that's being stipulated in the bill. So a company like AT&T, they have many, many employees, and they say, well, because it's going to cost us so much money, we're telling you right now that our earnings next year are going to be down by $1 billion or $1.5 billion. And then they go on to say that, well, now that we're going to lose this money, we are going to take another look at our retirement package and the people who are on retirement benefits at AT&T, and we may have to get the money from them.
Uh-huh.
So, in other words, these corporations, instead of them being forced to be more competitive, or the executive suite from taking a cut in their salary, they're just going to go else into the organization, and they're going to get their pound of flesh from somewhere else in the organization. And they're going to create a situation where the retirees are now going to go to battle with the people working at the company because they're taking the money from them. And so this is going to be interesting to see how Obama attacks this problem, because there's been 5 or 6 companies already that have come out with this very aggressive stance saying like, okay, well, it's a law. We have to obey the law. But to pay for it, we're going to take it from somewhere else. And this gets back to what I've said before about the fallacy of activists who go and meet CEOs of corporations and tell them, they go into Exxon and they'll say, hey, these are the 10 things you're doing to hurt the environment. And then they leave the office. The guy at Exxon just buys more insurance to cover the problems that were explained to him by the activists, and to pay for the insurance, they lower their operating standards. So net, they do more damage.
But like we were saying with the IMF gold, where they say they're selling it to raise money to help poor people. So they're selling real gold in order to help poor people. And yet at the same time, they created $250 billion in SDRs out of thin air. So why aren't they doing that to help poor people? These are the arguments that are used. And the same thing with Exxon, and same thing with this. They always pretend like these costs matter, and the costs will then matter to you, little peasant. But they know it's all fake. It's just virtual currency. But they say, we really have to pollute the earth. We really have to destroy the rainforest. Because if we don't, your virtual currency in your pocket will be worth less.
Yeah. I mean, AT&T could easily borrow $20 billion at a rate of virtually zero to pay for the healthcare costs if they wanted to. But the fact that they are now making it an issue by going after their retirees, it just shows you that they are basically just always looking at the side of the capitalist system that rewards them the most with the least risk. And anyone else in the system is getting the most of the risk with the least amount of reward. And this is the schism that needs to be addressed by re-architecting the entire global economy so that everybody is exposed to relatively balanced proportions of both reward and risk. The question is not risk, it's not reward or wealth redistribution. That's not the question on the table. The question is risk redistribution. The way that these banks on Wall Street and around the world make so much money is not because they're hoarding wealth. It's because they're reducing their risk. You see, if you can make $1 billion a year and not take any risk, that it makes you very, very profitable. Whereas Joe Blow bag of donuts down at the corner grocery store, for every dollar he makes, he's taking $10 of risk because he's not adequately insured. He's got all kinds of climate risk. He's got all kinds of inventory risk. I mean, it's an enormously risky
proposition.
Well,
it becomes a risky proposition to earn income at debt saturation point, because each new dollar creates a negative impact.
Right.
So at a certain point, it becomes negative to even earn money. You become poorer if you earn.
Yeah. I mean, since the 1970s, the proportion of risk to reward has gotten completely out of balance to the point where it's now, we can't even refer to it as free market capitalism anymore. It's rigged market capitalism. And the way to fix it is to rebalance the forces within the economy so that risk and reward are more evenly balanced. Nobody would complain about this. The corporations would not complain about this because it gives them a level playing field to compete. The reason that they're so insidious and rapacious is because their competitor is insidious and rapacious. And there's nobody there to, as a cop, telling them, look, here are the parameters under which you must do business. The referee is nowhere on the field. It's just basically hooligans beating the crap out of each other. And the people in the stands, everyone else, either they like to watch this kind of carnage or they're in the parking lot throwing up because they just lost their job and they have no coverage.
Bully, bully.
I reckon. But, you know, it's not out of the, you know, it's possible to do so. The CFTC, for example, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, they could completely rebalance all the futures trading markets in ways that would foster free market capitalism and steer the economy away from rigged market capitalism. The SEC in the States, the FSA in the UK, the similar regulatory bodies in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, could address this problem internally by re-architecting how risk and reward is distributed in the financial world.
But they're captured regulators.
That's right. They're captured by the very people they're supposed to be regulating. So they don't do it.
Because of that virtual currency. Because what, you know, you're regulating people or industries who tell you as you come in the door to regulate them, they say, oh, hi, Mr. SEC man. We have a job. You're so great. You know what? We have a job here for you once you're done with your year or two, making sure we don't face any fines.
Yeah.
We have a job for you paying 10 times whatever you're making now. We'll pay you 10 times that.
Right. And your job is to game the regulatory agency you just came from, but working for us.
Yes.
That's right.
It's like an apprenticeship at the SEC. You do. And it's like, it's over and over that they just, you know, nobody seems bothered by this. I have to tell you, like, obviously there's a strong vocal minority who are against it in the US or UK or Europe, but do they, you know, is there enough? No. You know, it takes more than 10% of the population to be concerned about this.
Because they have the lottery mentality. That they know it's rigged, but they might be today's big winner. So they do nothing. And I guess that's going to do it for this edition of Truth About Markets New Zealand. Max and Stacey, until next time. Bye, y'all.